This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. First up on the Memorial Day edition of Radio Times in Review, we listen to Marty's interview with two veterans of the U.S. Army, Roy Scranton and Matt Gallagher. The two collaborated on a book entitled Fire and Forget. And while many veterans may be inclined to use memoir to convey the realities of combat, Scranton and Gallagher instead decided that fiction would be a more astute route to express life during and after wartime. Marty talked with them in 2013 when they joined us in the WHYY studios. Let's take a listen.
Interesting that the foreword to this book by Colin McCann, he writes, all stories are war stories somehow. I mean, I hadn't thought of it quite that way, but this, it feels like there's some essential truth to that.
Well, conflict,
exactly.
Right, is at the heart of storytelling. There's another thing Colin quotes in his foreword, where Faulkner says that storytelling is about the human heart in conflict with itself. And so in that sense, absolutely, absolutely. And that's what these stories are in Fire and Forget. They're stories about you know, not just conflict on the battlefield, although that shows up, of course, but conflict within the human heart and within our own lives, how we deal with these decisions that we've made, how we live with them, how we work to, you know, live in these different worlds over there, over here, how you inhabit these different spaces, how you, you know, become, how you build yourself as one person out of these very different things.
And it also grew out of, sounds like, a lot of time spent in a bar in New York talking, not just the two of you, but others as well, and I guess shaping the idea for this anthology.
Yeah, no, I think it was an important thing for all of us as emerging writers to have a place to congregate and trade ideas and experiences. We're trying to find some way to tell something deeper than just I was there, just because I was there in Iraq or Afghanistan. We wanted to do something beyond that, and kind of in our formative writing years to have one another to bounce each other these ideas off of, sometimes at a bar, sometimes at a coffee shop, in case my mom's listening.
I think she'd understand.
It was very helpful. It was very helpful, and it's what led to this kind of this kaleidoscope collection of 15 stories, very distinct from one another, but unified in subject about Iraq, Afghanistan, or the home front back here in the States.
And I also read, Roy, that there were other names that you considered for Fire and Forget, including one, and I don't know whether you were being ironic about this, I almost hesitate to say it, one title being, Did You Kill Anybody?
Yeah, that's the question that shouldn't ever get asked.
I know, but it gets asked a lot, doesn't it?
It does. It more often than you would think. But even Fire and Forget, there's a certain irony in the title, of course, because, you know, that's what you can't do. If you pulled that trigger, it's not something that you can just let go of.
Yeah.
And how to remember that and how to work through that. Certainly, one of the key themes, the stories in this book.
Matt, why is that such a terrible question? Did you kill anybody?
Because it simplifies the complexities of the experience. It boils it down to a one word or one sentence answer. When going to war is so much more than that. There's a phrase called war porn. That, you know, people go on YouTube and watch 3-minute firefights so they can see what it's like, or, you know, they can play Call of Duty to get the experience, and it's demeaning. It strips away the 120 degree heat, the 20 hours that you've been awake on patrol preceding that 1-minute event. Someone from World War I said, you know, wars is mass boredom interrupted by sheer moments of chaos. And that experience was very true for many Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. So that question just takes away and diminishes all of that, almost for a voyeuristic thrill. That's why that question should never be asked.
Let me quote some. Did you want to add to that?
I wanted to add to that as well. Like another way that it strips away that complexity is that, you know, if you have
If you have killed
someone. If you have killed someone, then it was in a situation where, you know, there's complex decisions going on in a second. And, you know, to having to carry that weight and live with that. One of the stories in the collection, When Engaging Targets Remember, is a choose-your-own-adventure story that literally puts you in the gunner's hatch of a Humvee on convoy, where you have to decide whether or not to shoot this sedan that's coming at the convoy after an IED goes off. And the sedan could have an IED in it, or it could have a family. You don't know, but you have to decide in that moment, you know, what to do to protect your fellow soldiers. And that's the kind of decision, you know, that a soldier has to live with. And that's the kind of decision that gets evaporated and effaced by that question.
Well, it's not a video game, right?
It's not a video game. It's real lives.
Let me quote something from the preface. In a sense, this entire volume is dedicated to every soldier or Marine who found coming back to the Mall of America stranger even than their first time under fire. Matt?
Yeah, no, it's not a coincidence that many of the stories in Fire Forget are homecoming stories. Because, you know, we like to think, I know before I went to Iraq myself, I thought war was something I would go to and hopefully come back from, and same with my men. What I didn't understand is it's something that will live within me the rest of my life and will by proxy my close loved ones. I think one of my favorite stories in the collection that touches upon this is Siobhan Fallon's Tips for a Smooth Transition. Siobhan is a military spouse herself and writes from the perspective in her story of a military spouse who's waiting for her Army officer husband to come home, armed only with a 1,000-word magazine article giving her tips for how to welcome him home. Of course, those bullet points don't come in handy, and she finds herself having to ad hoc figure it out as these two people who love each other dearly try to reconcile what the past year has meant to both of them and hopefully how they can come together and go forward. There's no smooth, easy answers to that, and I think that's why Siobhan's story succeeds so well.
Interesting, including a military spouse in this book of stories written almost entirely by veterans.
Yeah, that was an easy decision to make, in part because Siobhan's just such a great writer and such a great storyteller, but also because it was important to have that perspective of, you know, what a soldier looks like when they come home, not just from the soldier's view, but what it looks like from the people at home. And, you know, being married into the military, you're practically in the military yourself. So we're really, really proud to have Siobhan with us.
I remember a couple of months ago doing a show about the Iraq War, and someone said, you know, that's the other 1%. There was so much talk about the wealthy being, you know, the 1% of this country. And the guest was saying, no, the other 1% are the military people and their families who have either served in Iraq or Afghanistan, and what a tiny, tiny percentage of the population it is.
Right. I mean, so different compared to the Vietnam generation, which was, you know, a societal and cultural scar across the country. People had to deal with it, whether they were supporting it, whether they were protesting it, whatever. With Iraq and Afghanistan, it's almost an unforeseen byproduct of the all-volunteer force. If people don't want to deal with these wars, it was very simple for them to avoid. As a result, kind of a subculture of people that were bearing the burden arose out of that. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the right answer is. We're not going back to a draft. But just because it wasn't your son or daughter fighting in Iraq or Afghanistan, it was someone's. And I think going forward, as we deal with the carnage that these wars wrought in multiple countries, I think it's so vital to remember that just because the wars end doesn't mean that its effects are going to. And it'll be. I really hope that we as a country don't continue to turn a blind eye to that.
Yeah. Let me go back to you, and I printed out something, some remarks that you gave at a panel on Veterans Day. This was at the Woodrow Wilson School for Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. And it grew out of a woman that came up to you and shook your hand and got misty-eyed and, you know, thanked you for your service. And from there, you wrote a really interesting piece about what those, how those words resonated with you, and but also how it raised a whole bunch of different questions.
Yeah, it was. I'd just come off the plane from Iraq, and you know, there was there were all these people greeting us and thanking us, and I, you know, it was very difficult to know what to do with that, because they seemed to be more interested in feeling their gratitude and a sort of you know, feeling good about thanking us, rather than even wanting to know anything about what we'd actually done or what we were doing, you know, which puts us in a strange position, puts, you know, a veteran in a strange position. Do you fulfill those expectations? Do you cut them down and say something rude? You know, do you try to negotiate out of that? All these very difficult things with what people want to hear from veterans, how people want to use veterans for their own emotional or political ends, or just what people think that veterans want to hear. You know, we're all sort of stuck in these conversations that are based on conventions that may not have much to do with what's actually going on.
Well, Amanda, I think people, myself included, have said those things, you know, thank you for your service, in part perhaps because of the Vietnam War and how veterans felt so mistreated by the public, and wanting to somehow, you know, not repeat that. But as I was reading your piece, Roy, I understand that the sort of shallowness that can be for a veteran, or experience as a veteran.
Yeah, it can come across that way sometimes. Other times, you can tell that they mean it, and that they just don't know how else to express it. It's so tough to pin down, but because it's become, you know, yellow, it never really evolved past the yellow ribbon on the back of the truck. But there are opportunities out there for people to truly show their support. Hire a veteran. You know, as young corporals at 20 years old, they were managing, you know, $500,000 worth of equipment. I'm sure they can hold down the morning shift at your small business. Maybe you don't know the kid down the street all that well. Why not buy him lunch and talk to him like a kid down the street, rather than a veteran that you're trying to pry into? There are real meaningful ways for people to express their gratitude, and it starts with thank you for your service, but it can't end there.
That was Marty's 2013 interview with Roy Scranton and Matt Gallagher, two U.S. Army veterans who collaborated on the book of fiction entitled Fire and Forget. This is the Memorial Day edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moscowane. When we get back, we'll hear Marty's conversation with Marine veteran Dan Sheehan about his adjustment from Cobra pilot to civilian. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Memorial Day edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moscowane. We've all had the experience of having to come down from an adrenaline high, returning to day-to-day life after a transcendent moment that felt extraordinary. Perhaps no one experiences this extreme shift more than those engaged in intense warfare. Marine veteran Dan Sheehan examined this dynamic in his book, After Action. He flew a Cobra helicopter in several missions, including the initial invasion of Iraq, in which he engaged in serious combat and employed deadly firepower. But it was upon his return to civilian life that he noticed something worth chronicling. Let's listen to Marty's 2013 interview with Dan Sheehan, author of After Action, The True Story of a Cobra Pilot's Journey.
You come from a military family going back several generations. You chose to be a Marine. Why the Marine Corps?
Well, I knew late in high school that I wanted to serve, and I was very interested in flying. However, I wasn't quite sure that I would make it through flight school. And had I not made it through flight school, I knew that I did not want to serve on a Navy ship someplace. I would prefer to be a grunt. I would have much rather have been an infantry Marine than serving on the ship. What I came to realize later on, though, is that if you fail out of flight school as a Marine, you don't get to go into the infantry. The infantry is a very highly sought after and prestigious occupation in the Marine Corps. So generally speaking, if I hadn't made it through, I would have probably been pushing papers someplace.
Oh, interesting. Well, you did become a Cobra helicopter pilot. And as you describe it in the book, the pilot is the guy that ruled the battlefield, your words.
Well, that's certainly how I saw it from someone on the outside looking in and going through my initial training. The Cobra just provides very immediate and overwhelming firepower at any place on the battlefield. And so it was something that I felt a very strong draw to do.
Kill the enemy and blow his stuff up.
Yes.
That was your, in a sense, that was your mission.
Exactly, yeah. There's not a whole lot of search and rescue that you do from a gunship. You pretty much just destroy things.
Well, you have pretty vivid descriptions of flying this helicopter. Literally, as the war is beginning in Iraq, you go from Kuwait to Iraq, and your job is to sort of clear the way as the military moves into the country. And your descriptions of looking down through the dust, through all the sort of chaos, through potential air fire, is frightening and very confusing.
I wrote it expressly with that intent, because it was confusing. It may not have been frightening at the time, but it was very confusing and a very chaotic situation. And from the front seat of a Cobra, you have some very highly magnified sensors that allow you to look at a very long distance out at targets. However, you have a very small field of view, so it's almost like looking at through a telescope at an area. And it's difficult to maintain your situational awareness as to what's immediately mm-hmm. around you. That responsibility generally fell on my backseater, Gash, who we flew every mission together. He's a very close friend of mine. But he maintained the situational awareness around our aircraft while I looked deep for targets.
You even describe, even before the war began, I guess you were in East Timor flying, and you saw two men on a hill, and it was, or perhaps even it was a mountain, and you weren't sure, do they have a gun? What are they holding? And you almost fired at them until you realized what?
Until I realized that the man kneeling in the middle of the road with the small flash in front of his face wasn't taking a shot at me. He was actually taking a picture. And the man that had something sticking up over his back that I thought was initially an RPG was just a guitar.
Right.
And it was, you know, I went through probably 2 miles of flight path closing with these two men on the road, believing them to be hostile, and getting ready to engage before the sights cleared up just enough for me to get that final picture that said, no, abort.
And that was just sort of that final second, right?
Exactly. We were well within, if they were readying weapons and if they were engaging us, we were well within their weapon engagement zone. So they would have been placing accurate fire on us by that point. But there are some points where you have to delay and take that risk.
Well, in fact, the guy with the guitar was singing.
He was.
I mean, that's why his body language sort of looked perhaps like he might have an RPG.
Well, and the neck of the guitar sticking up over his shoulder was what my eye cued on. And, you know, I was looking for weapons. And when something fit that template, then it certainly got all of my attention.
Did you feel like the training you got as a Cobra pilot, as a Marine, prepared you for war? Is there anything that prepares anybody for war?
Well, I will say that I was extremely well prepared for the physical requirements of combat and for the technical and tactical requirements of flying a gunship in combat. What I was unprepared for was the human cost of doing so. And it remains to be seen whether I think you can prepare somebody fully for that before they go into war or not. And I don't think that it's something we have really tried to do. And that is something that I'm focusing my efforts on with both with this book and with my blog and follow-on writing.
Well, I mean, because what you vividly describe is the fear, the excitement, the adrenaline. I mean, all of that sort of all at the same time as you're flying these missions.
It's an incredibly intoxicating cocktail of emotions, and they're. You really get to freebase life when you're in combat. Regular emotions after those sorts of experiences tend to pale in comparison, and your personal knowledge of how high the highs can be and how low the lows can be has really been expanded by the experience, and it's difficult to transition back from that.
Does it feel addictive? I mean, are there
Absolutely.
Times it feels addictive?
Absolutely. There's an addictive focus on the present that is incredibly freeing. You don't worry about the past or the future when you're in combat because you may not have the future to worry about if you don't focus on the present. And that gets to the compartmentalization that I talk about and the issues stemming from continued compartmentalization after the need to do so is over.
So it's action, reaction in the present moment.
Yes.
You say nothing in my life had prepared me for the tunnel vision, the pounding heart, the sheer excitement of the scramble, or maybe everything had. So it's everything all at once at the same time.
Absolutely. And you shift so quickly between absolute mind-numbing fear and overwhelming euphoria that you don't have time to register those emotions. You're just on a roller coaster that is at the same time terrifying and exhilarating.
And you had this guy Gash, you know, behind you, and the kind of bond, I guess, we talk about the band of brothers, but it's a real thing, right?
It is, very much so. You know, Gash and I knew each other from flight school on, and we had been close friends before we ever flew together, and then we were lucky enough to get assigned to the same squadron. And all the guys that I flew with during the invasion phase were all part of We had all flown together for almost 13 months and almost exclusively for those 13 months prior because we'd been out on a regularly scheduled deployment on a Western Pacific cruise, came back and we were home for 3 weeks before we got thrown back on a ship and over for the invasion. And our squadron that we got assigned to, HMLA 267, was very smart in that they recognized that we were we were already a unit. And they didn't break us apart. They allowed us to fight and fly together as a kind of a subunit within them. And that was a very smart move by our CO.
And I guess being with your buddies, your friends certainly is helpful. But did you talk to each other about how frightened you were or all the things that you write about in this book? Or was that something you had to seal off?
No, we really didn't talk about that. And there had been a couple of flights on our initial deployment in Djibouti and other places that were more terrifying than anything that we saw in combat. And we talked briefly about those, generally stating, wow, that was the worst flight we'd ever been through.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until I asked Gash to read an early copy of the book that any of us started talking about the after effects. And that's really the effect that I've found this book has had, that After Action has had on folks who have read it, other veterans. You know, I keep it very, very narrowly focused on my experiences and my emotions, even to the point of, you know, I don't explain how or I don't project anything onto Gash throughout the book. That's not my place to do so. However, by laying out my own emotions and my own reactions to things, it welcomes others to do the same.
And is that because you were all Marines, you had a war to fight, there was no sort of letting down guard because of this sort of Marine, what, persona or even a mask?
Yes, very much a mask. And it's a, you know, I recognized through writing that I had a very incomplete understanding of what it meant to be a warrior. And I firmly believed myself to be a warrior, had spent a long time training to achieve that sort of cognition in my own head. But what I found out was that it was very shallow.
Yeah.
It was focused on being a tough guy and nothing can bother me. I'm a steely-eyed, you know, merchant of death. And that's part of being a warrior, but it doesn't recognize the human cost of assuming that life.
You even describe times when you weren't fighting, when you were, you know, had a couple of days off that, yeah, you'd sleep for the first 24 hours, but then you were itchy to get back, but also felt angry. I mean, there were these flashes of anger and rage.
I found it was very easy to compartmentalize when I was in the aircraft. It was very easy to push away thoughts and emotions and anything outside my immediate reality. When I didn't have my job to focus on, when I was sitting on back in the tent or when I was back in Kuwait waiting for the next flight, those uncomfortable reactions and emotions started to come out of where I'd shoved them, and it was extremely disconcerting. I took it as a sign of weakness that I was not maintaining my focus, and to drop your focus in combat is a very bad thing. And you know, this is a relatively short duration. This is 3 weeks. There are a lot of veterans who have much longer experiences having to maintain that serious compartmentalization that forms a real challenge.
And you had to just wall that off.
Yes.
For that time.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you did go back to Iraq, and it sounds like you wanted to. You wanted to go back.
I absolutely did. And I was given an opportunity to serve as a forward air controller with a new Marine Special Operations unit. And I jumped at the chance. It was an incredible experience. I got to work with some of the absolute best Marines I've ever known at Det 1. And the experiences that I had there were everything I'd ever wanted to do in the Marine Corps. I got to go to combat on the ground. I got to work with these incredible men and jump out of airplanes and do the fun grunt stuff that I'd always kind of enjoyed.
You also describe, and this is always such an awkward thing for an interviewer that has never been to war, that would be me, because you do write about killing people. You do write about seeing the sort of aftermath of some of what you did in Iraq. And it sounds like you also have been haunted by some of those images and even questions about, am I a good person? You know, am I a good person because I've done this?
Indeed. With the high magnification of the Cobra's sensors, they might be a mile away, but they might as well be in your front seat. You know, when you're seeing the effects of your decisions, and I felt very, my job in the front seat of the Snake was to find someone, determine whether they were enemy combatants or not, and if they were, to kill them as efficiently and as quickly as possible. And there's a sequence of actions that have to happen in order to achieve that final trigger pull and then, quite honestly, fly the missile into that individual. That makes it very personal. And that was something that I, in the aftermath, was not able to lay a blanket statement of, hey, they're enemy, I can do this. Or, I'm not... It's not my choice to pull this trigger. I'm here because this is my duty. All of that is true. However, it still was my decision to kill that person. And that is the basic truth of being in the military in combat, is that you choose to kill another person. And that is what I've figured out through writing that was truly bothering me at a fundamental level.
In a way that was probably hard for you to recognize at the time, right?
Absolutely.
Because this is what you wanted to do, and this is what you were asked to do and required to do.
Absolutely. It was very difficult to come to grips with that in the heat of the moment. And I write about a time when I came close to that, when I actually went and I talked to a chaplain, and it was the most worthless conversation that I thought I'd ever had. And again, it wasn't until later that I realized it wasn't worthless at all, because I had kind of gone to the chaplain expecting him to be some sort of happiness fairy who would have given me the ominous dominus and then, hey, you're good to go, off you go. And I would have felt great. Well, it doesn't work that way. And that's I had to come to that realization by exposing myself to this chaplain and going, hey, you know, what does God think about all this? And his explanation was so shallow and trite that I said, you know, I got mad at myself. Why did I even entertain this question?
What did he say?
It started along the lines of, well, do you think Saddam's a bad guy? I said, well, yeah, Saddam's a bad guy. I'm like, okay, do you think we're doing the right thing by removing him from power? I said, yeah, sure. Got it. What about me? You know, where do I fall out here? And he kind of stopped there and looked at me. And that's when dangerous emotions started bubbling up and I left. I had to get out of that that little hut because it wasn't going to be a pleasant conversation from that point on.
Because you had to be vulnerable, right? You were.
Very much exposed a part of myself that I didn't trust or understand, in the hopes that he would be able to give me some ecclesiastical knowledge that would have fixed it. And it doesn't exist. You know, it didn't exist for me.
But what's interesting is that it was there. I mean, here you were doing your job in a sense, but you still, underneath it all, were questioning yourself or having some uncomfortable thoughts about what was going on.
And I think some of that stems from the fact that when I was flying, when I was in combat, it was very intense and it was very focused. But I also, when I landed in Kuwait, I might as well have been at 29 Palms. I was back in a tent. There was a TV. There's a TV in the chow hall. There's food. So there are the incredible peaks of intensity followed by incredible lulls between the action, and that's when this stuff seeped in. You know, it might have been different had I been in a Humvee driving north, because there's no downtime then, and so you stay up on that edge, Thus, when you do come home and when you do have the downtime, that drop is precipitous.
We just listened to Marty's 2013 interview with Marine veteran and author Dan Sheehan, author of After Action, The True Story of a Cobra Pilot's Journey. This is the Memorial Day edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. After the break, we'll listen to Marty's conversation with poet Elise Fenton. Her husband served in Iraq, which provided the basis for her award-winning collection called Clamor. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. We round out our Memorial Day edition of the show by listening to Marty's conversation with Philadelphia-based poet Elise Fenton. While her husband was serving as a medic in Iraq, Fenton used their snippets of communication, news stories, and her experiences as a wife on the home front to create a vivid book of poetry called Clamor. The book went on to win the 2010 Dylan Thomas Award, of which the chief judge described Fenton's work as an astonishing, fully accomplished book of huge ambition and spectacular delivery. Let's take a listen to Marty's interview with poet Elise Fenton from 2011.
The title of your book is Clamor, and one of the poems is called Clamor. What do you mean by that? And I have to say, I even went to Wikipedia just to sort of see, what does this word clamor mean? What does it mean to you?
Yeah, well, the epigraph of the book is sort of essentially clamor, and it's the definition. And this was kind of one of those happy coincidences where I was using the word, I was using clamor. I'd used it in a number of poems before I did what I often do, which is I turned to my dictionary and I was like, you know, I had an inkling that it meant more than what I thought. And what I discovered was it does mean noise. It means a noisy shouting, a loud continuous noise. It can mean insistent public expression, support or protest. But the third meaning is silence. Mm. And, you know, it's one of those words that means
both noise and silence.
Yeah, its own opposite. And so I knew, I mean, I sort of intuitively knew that this was a concept that I had been working with. And when I saw the definition, it was clear that this is, I was working with noise and silence. And
well, I'd love to have you read the poem Clamor.
Sure. Clamor. Staking fencing along the border of the spring garden, I want suddenly to say something about this word that means sound and soundlessness at once. The deafening metal of my hammer strikes wood, a tuning fork tuning my ears to a register I'm too deaf to understand. Across the yard, each petal dithers from the far pear, one white cheek at a time, like one blade of snow into the next, until the yard looks like the sound of a television screen tuned last night to late night static. White as a page or a field, where I often go to find the promise of evidence of you or your unit's safe return. But instead of footprints in the frosted static, there's only late-turned early news and the newest image of a war that can't be finished or won. And because last night I turned away from the television's promise of you, I'm still away. I've staked myself, deep to the unwrung ground, hammer humming in my hand, the screen's aborted stop time still turning over in my head, a white twist of rag pinned in the bloody center of a civilian's chest, a sign we know just enough to know it means surrender, there in the place a falling petal's heart would be.
And that's our guest, Elise Fenton, reading a poem called Clamor from her collection of poems. The book is called Clamor, and she just won the Dylan Thomas Prize. And I have to say, I love that poem, first of all, for the imagery. I mean, you go from the hammer to the pedal into the war, and then this notion of sound and silence, and included in that sound, and it seems like it's in a lot of these poems here, is the sound of the TV set, right?
Which is funny, because I didn't actually have a TV set. But I think this visual static becomes sort of sonic static.
And I would assume, you know, as someone who has a loved one who's in a war, as your husband was in Iraq, that you have this really ambivalent relationship with whether it's the TV news or the radio news or just news itself.
Yeah. I mean, I think I would go through, and I think this is very common, I would swing wildly between being kind of a glutton for that information and wanting nothing to do with it. And I think the one thing that I really had a hard time stepping away from was reading the names of the dead, that New York Times sort of ticker daily. Because I knew that, you know, whatever actual news was coming out, I would read into it too much, or mm-hmm. I would, you know, and
of course, I mean, that seems like, of course you would. Right?
Yeah. And you know, and my husband was, I think he had a hard time understanding because he felt like he was relatively, you know, safe, as safe as you can be in the green zone in Baghdad at the time. And he had a hard time understanding how I could possibly spin out these stories as so, but just potentially fraught as they were.
But was that your imagination? Those were your feelings? I mean, that's kind of where your mind goes when your husband, in this case, is at war.
Yeah.
Or in a war zone.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a different experience for the person who's there and the person who's not.
And I'm curious, I read about the fact that obviously you and your husband would communicate with each other, and I know it's also difficult to communicate when someone is so far away and in such a fraught part of the world. How much do you think those conversations sort of work their way into the poems?
I mean, a fair amount. We spoke on the phone a little bit until we realized just how ridiculously expensive it was. And also the connections were pretty bad and the time zone was hard to work around. I was in class and he was, you know, it would be the middle of his night. But we, after a while, we realized because he was lucky to have an internet connection. And so we instant messaged, you know, maybe 4 or 5 times a week. And a lot of the time, a lot of mornings, we would sit down and we'd be instant messaging and, you know, he would have to go back to work or I would have to go to school or something, but I would have the screen, sort of the screenshots saved. And so it was, those are the fragments those were the scraps of material that initially sort of launched me into these poems.
And I guess the phone connection was so difficult, or as you say, your schedules were so sort of unconnected. It was hard to talk because I would think it'd be hard not to hear that person's voice.
Yeah, although it's hard not to have that human connection. But at the same time, when you have that human connection, it's also, you know, it's maybe equally fraught. Like, you know, let's
you have to say
you
goodbye.
Have a couple,
right?
You have a couple of minutes, and there's the human, but it's, but the other person is sort of stripped of. You know, you're still dealing with the distance, and in some ways, it's easier if you're not reminded of that, you know, very humanness, like in whispering in your ear.
Your husband was actually interviewed by one of the reporters here, Susan Phillips, and he has such a different, interesting experience of these poems, basically saying that didn't happen to me, you know, that what you describe in these poems is not his experience.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think he is understandably wary of the way that he is sort of thrust into the spotlight. And I think as sort of general readers, we want to read autobiography from this. And it's not. I mean, it can't be. It's for one, it's a poem, and
yes,
it's not his. And even if it were his, it still wouldn't be, you know, honest to the quote-unquote facts. But, you know, at the same time, they come from experiences. Or they come from my experience of his experience. And so there's a fair amount of a non-writer might call it liberties, although
it's certainly
you know, it's poetry.
Yes.
So,
and you're allowed to do that.
Yes, yeah, you are allowed.
But it seemed like what he was saying, he didn't want people to think that he was in more danger than perhaps these poems put him in. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I mean these were exceptions. These were general exceptions to his perception of safety over the course of that year. But yeah, I mean nobody wants to be seen as sort of more heroic than they are, I think, and it's a sensitive issue.
You wrote a piece a couple of years ago, for the New York Times about being a quote unquote war bride, which is such a, I mean, in some ways it's an old fashioned way of thinking about war and marriage, but it also is very provocative. War bride.
Yeah, and I think I apply it to myself sort of with tongue in cheek, because it is. It feels like an antiquated term, and anybody who knows me, you know, I was sort of an unsuspecting war bride. We literally got married and didn't tell anybody about it. And
you got married long distance. I mean, through the
yeah,
the FedEx,
essentially,
right?
Essentially, yeah. But it is. I mean, you know, I do feel a certain connection or solidarity with, you know, the World War II era war brides, although it was a different culture.
Sure.
It's a different world now.
And in this article that you describe, and this kind of picks up a little bit of what you were saying earlier about how the military would tell war brides, you know, keep it light. Don't burden, it would be your husband, obviously, don't burden your husband with what might be going on at home and the kind of responsibility of being a war bride.
Yeah, it's wild. And I don't remember where exactly that article came from, but I remember like stumbling across it on the internet. Sort of, it was kind of a good housekeeping tone. But it wasn't old. It was contemporary. It was, you know, that was sort of the advice on what you do when your partner is deployed, and it just, you know, it seemed laughable. That was, you know, we hadn't updated our notions of that role, of that experience.
But I could also understand, if I were a war bride, the desire to want to protect, you know, my husband if he were in harm's way in some way with what might be troubling me at home. I mean, I would think that impulse is sort of a natural one to have.
I guess. You know, I feel
you're
like
shaking your head.
Yeah,
maybe
more
not
than anything. Like, I think we would rather level with each other, and I think that we would feel betrayed in some way if we weren't.
If you weren't honest with what was actually going on in your life. Yeah, which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to have you actually read another poem, and this one is called Gratitude. I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about sort of where this poem came from, because, again, it's beautiful and provocative.
Yeah, thanks. So this poem, this is actually the first poem of the book, and it was one of the earlier poems in the book. And I wanted to begin the book itself with gratitude, with the concept of gratitude. The notion of being grateful from the beginning in this book that is in part about witnessing some forms of terror. And the poem, it came from I think it might have actually come from a phone conversation we had, and there are some there's maybe a fragment or two of the original language, but this was, you know, this is what I heard of his narrative.
I'd love to have you read it.
Okay. In gratitude. Wreckage was still smoldering on the airport road when they delivered the soldier, beyond recognition, seeing God's hands in the medevac's spun rotors, to the station's gravel landing pad. By the time you arrived, there were already hands fluttering white flags of gauze against the ruptured scaffolding of ribs, the glistening skull, and no skin left untended, so you were the one to sink the rubber catheter tube. When you tell me this over the phone, hours later, I can hear rotors scalping the tarmac gray sky, the burdenless lift of your voice. And I love you more for holding the last good flesh of that soldier's c**k in your hands, for startling his warm blood back to life. Listen, I know the way the struck cord begins to shudder, fierce heat rising into the skin of my own sensate palms. That moment just before we think the end will never come, and then the moment when it does.
And that's Elise Fenton reading from the beginning, the beginning poem in her collection of poetry called Clamor, and that's a poem called Gratitude. And again, your use of language here is so powerful, and also this imagery. I mean, we go from death to sex within really a couple of lines.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that's actually I took a class in grad school, and I think I took the class after I'd written this poem, but it was called Sex and Death.
Ah,
And because you know, I think in poetry and also in the world, there's a lot of overlap between that material and especially in the position of the, you know, the quote unquote war bride.
Yes.
These are kind of two, you know, fundamental human things that occupy minds.
And I'm wondering, as you say, you know, many liberties in this poem, but I wonder, you know, was your husband the one to sink the rubber catheter tube?
Why, yes.
Okay,
he did sink the rubber catheter tube, you know, which is a, you know, not a heroizing detail.
It's the medicine, the war, the death, and then, as I said, the sort of sexual sensuality as well.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's a common question. People are like, well, okay, but what was actually true?
Exactly.
But what, you know, I want to know why, you know, why is that the question? What difference would that make in a reading?
Well, I mean, from my perspective would be, because I know that these poems came from your experience of being here and having a husband who was in a war zone. And I think, you know, part of at least a reader or listener or viewer sort of wants to understand how does that person fit into this experience? Obviously, knowing in poetry or fiction or in film, great liberties can be taken, mm-hmm. but sort of wanting to know sort of it, within all this fiction, you know, is there something that's true that actually did happen that I can sort of understand?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, we're gluttons for
we are.
Authenticity. And,
we are.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it's sort of navigating those questions and navigating mm-hmm. in poetry, because, you know, as a poet, you know, I'd say, well, what? I'm not even going to answer that question. Why does that matter?
Of course.
How does that change your reading experience? How does that change the composition of the piece? And it doesn't. But I understand that this is, you know, this collection is reaching different audiences, and it's, you know, it's kind of it's a human mm-hmm. interest story. Mm-hmm. It's timely, and I'm glad for that.
Yeah. And we are at war. I mean, that's the other
thing,
too.
Exactly. If only because this is sort of bringing the attention of people back to mm-hmm. both wars. And I think that I've lived in relatively, you know, polarized places, and I think that as a reminder, this is crucial.
Mm.
That was Marty's 2011 conversation with Philadelphia poet Elise Fenton, author of Clamor. That wraps up the Memorial Day edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for listening.